Ruth, the story of Ruth in chapter 2. And we're reading this evening from verse 10 through to the end of the chapter. Ruth 2, from verse 10 through to verse 23. Then she fell on her face and bowed herself to the ground and said unto him, "Why have I found grace in thine eyes, that thou shouldest take knowledge of me, seeing I am a stranger?" And Boaz answered and said unto her, "It hath fully been showed me all that thou hast done unto thy mother-in-law since the death of thine husband, and how thou hast left thy father and thy mother in the land of thy nativity, and art come unto a people which thou knewest not heretofore. The Lord recompense thy work, and a full reward be given thee of the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings thou art come to trust." Then she said, "Let me find favor in thy sight, my Lord, for that thou hast comforted me, and for that thou hast spoken friendly unto thine handmaid, though I be not like unto one of thine handmaidens." And Boaz said unto her, "At mealtime come thou hither, and eat of the bread, and dip thy morsel in the vinegar." And she sat beside the reapers, and he reached her parched corn, and she did eat and was sufficed and left. And when she was risen up to glean, Boaz commanded his young men, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves, and reproach her not. And let fall also some of the handfuls of purpose for her, and leave them that she may glean them, and rebuke her not." So she gleaned in the field until even, and beat out that she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. And she took it up and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned, and she brought forth and gave to her that she had reserved after she was sufficed. And her mother-in-law said unto her, "Where hast thou gleaned today, and where wroughtest thou? Blessed be he that did take knowledge of thee." And she showed her mother-in-law with whom she had wrought, and said, "The man's name with whom I wrought today is Boaz." And Naomi said unto her daughter-in-law, "Blessed be he of the Lord, who hath not left off his kindness to the living and to the dead." And Naomi said unto her, "The man is a near of kin unto us, one of our next kinsmen." And Ruth the Moabitess said, "He said unto me also, 'Thou shalt keep fast by my young men until they have ended all my harvest.'" And Naomi said unto Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It is good, my daughter, that thou go out with his maidens, and they meet thee not in any other field." So she kept fast by the maidens of Boaz to glean unto the end of the barley harvest and of the wheat harvest, and dwelt with her mother-in-law. And amen. This week, since last Tuesday, I was speaking to a man who was surprised that we are one of the few fellowships that have two nights of midweeks. And he understood that a night for prayer seemed sensible, but thought that a night dedicated to Bible study was excessive. And we were talking about that, and we have discussed it often as a fellowship, of course. But in the conversation that transpired and followed, he suggested that Christians only should concentrate on the New Testament. In fact, if pushed, he said that Christians should only focus on the four Gospels because they're all about Christ, and the Christian walk is all about following Christ. He further went on to say that in his mind, much of the Old Testament has been called into question by modern technology. A scissors and paste kind of theology. And he would have cut out most of the Old Testament, most of the epistles, certainly the book of Revelation, and left himself just with the Gospels. This is a professing believer. Let me state from this pulpit that the Bible is inspired from Genesis to Revelation. Can I say to you that the Bible in its entirety is vital for our spiritual maturity? And certainly there are passages that are harder to understand than others, but it is therefore our spiritual maturity. And as we mature, maybe we tackle some of those more difficult passages. Could I also say, as I said to the dear man this week, let me state that there has been no archaeological discovery that has ever controverted a biblical reference that I am aware of. In fact, the opposite is the case. There are scores of archaeological finds that have confirmed in clear outline or have confirmed in exact detail historical statements in the Bible. I think of verses like Psalm 85 and verse 11. Truth will spring out of the earth. And I believe that is a reference to archaeology and how truth is confirmed through archaeology. I think of verses like Psalm 119, verse 89. Forever, O Lord, thy word is settled in heaven. And if you want to go into this, of course, there are men like Professor Nelson Glueck, who was a professor. He's dead now, but for 30 years he said that he excavated sites with his Bible in one hand and a trowel in the other. The other man, Dr. Meredith Klein, was an expert in biblical archaeology and found amazing things. And there is, of course, the Biblical Archaeological Review that you can get. Let me just give you one little example that I seen back in May when I was in the Holy Land. I was aware of it before. Pilate, that we will be dealing with Christmas time, Pilate, the pure creator of Judea at the time of Christ, he was unknown in the history books. No one could find any details of him. It seemed as if he had been wiped out of the annals of history. And so the archaeologists came to Christians and said, well, there you are. There is no evidence of this man, Pilate. There is no evidence of him being in authority. That was until they were excavating in the port of Caesarea. And we were there and we saw the excavations in May. And they found a stone, which was a stone celebrating the opening of the amphitheater. And there, who opened it but Pilate? And all of a sudden, the archaeologists had to eat their words. Turns out that he had displeased the Roman authorities and he was wiped out as much as they could, wipe him out of history. But again, truth shall spring out of the earth. And the word of God was vindicated once more. By way of introduction tonight, I want to touch on what for some is a theological problem. And that is, and many Christians have debated it, of course, the question is, when did Ruth become a child of God? When was she accepted into the commonwealth of Israel? Was it in chapter 1, whenever she declared her resolve to travel with her mother-in-law Naomi, entreat me not to leave thee, thy people shall be my people, thy God shall be my God, and so on. Some will say, yes, that's where it is. That's where she made her commitment. And others will say, no, that's impossible. She's not met Boaz yet. And Boaz is a picture of Jesus Christ. You can't be converted without him. Others will say chapter 2, when Boaz falls in love with her. And that is the changing. He provides for her. He cares for her. She comes under his protection. And some will say, yes, it's chapter 2. And others will say, impossible. The price of her redemption has not been paid yet. And so it cannot be in chapter 2. The kinsman redeemer hasn't paid the price. Some will say chapter 3, when Boaz pays the price and he's able to marry Ruth. And maybe that's where it is, or maybe there are options 4, 5, and 6. You will understand and appreciate that Old Testament believers did not come to God in the same way as you and me. Now, it was a step of faith exactly the same as you and me. But you take, for example, Abraham. Abraham was converted to God without a godly upbringing. He got converted to God without any church meetings, without any gospel meetings or an evangelist or a Bible. Abraham never met a character like Boaz. This pagan man from Ur of the Chaldees was stopped in his tracks when the God of heaven spoke to him. Jehovah spoke into his life and he never was the same again. And we could look at the testimonies of Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and Moses and Joshua. Many, many characters whose path to faith was maybe different than what we would be aware of. And they never had an encounter with a Boaz type character who spoke of or represented Jesus Christ. And so I would argue that it's a weak argument that Ruth cannot have been a true follower of God until she met Boaz. I have mentioned before that the key is found in Ruth chapter 2 verse 12, where Boaz said to Ruth, "Under whose wings thou art come to trust." Now I have heard many preachers preach on this, and many of them, when they talk about "under whose wings thou art come to trust," and they will turn to Luke chapter 13 and verse 34, where it says, "How oft would I have gathered thy children together as a hen doth gather her brood under her wings, yet ye would not." Beautiful picture of the mother hen caring and protecting her chicks. But I don't think that is at all what Boaz was talking about. Some theologians link it into the wings of an eagle and how they're able to soar up to amazing heights, and they see their prey maybe a mile or 2 miles away, and they, with a like a guided missile, come down to snatch their prey, and they get wonderful lessons from it. I don't think that's what Boaz was thinking about. While they do have eagles in Israel, when we turn to Psalm 36, verses 7 and 8, we read this: "How excellent is thy loving kindness, O God! Therefore the children of men put their trust under the shadow of thy wings. They shall be abundantly satisfied with the fatness of thy house, and thou shalt make them drink of the river of thy pleasures." I think this is the key. The psalmist is talking about the house of God. And where do we find wings in the house of God? You go past the courtyard. You go through the holy place. You pull back the thick curtain from the Holy of Holies. And you see in the Holy of Holies there the Ark of the Covenant. And there above the Ark of the Covenant, above the lid of the mercy seat, where the blood is sprinkled on the Day of Atonement, there are the two cherubim with their wings spread, almost touching God's earthly dwelling place. And I think this is where she had come to trust. The place of sacrifice, the place where the blood was shed, the place where the blood is applied. That is our place of safety. And Ruth, whatever stage she had come to faith, she had come under the protection of his wings, the place of sacrifice, the place of the bloodshed. And so we come to Psalm 61 and verse 4 that says, "I will abide in thy tabernacle forever. I will trust in the covert of thy wings." Selah. Or Psalm 91, "He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. He shall cover thee with his feathers. Under his wings shalt thou trust. His truth shall be thy shield and buckler." So I don't know when Ruth became a child of God. But I do know that when Boaz spoke to her in Ruth chapter 2 and verse 12, Boaz affirms that Ruth's confidence and trust was in the place of sacrifice on the seat of mercy, sheltering under the wings of the cherubim in the Holy of Holies, resting under the wings. Let's get into the text. Last time, in fact, the last few weeks, we have been working our way through six words that are found in chapter 2 of Ruth. By way of summary, we have looked at determination. She was determined. Let me go and glean in the field. We saw the compassion. She protected her mother-in-law. We saw the affection, instruction, provision, and inspiration. And I was going to go straight into chapter 3 tonight, but I want to add a seventh word to the list. And that is, I want to add satisfaction. And there in verse 14, Boaz said to her at mealtime, "Come thou hither and eat of the bread and dip thy morsel in the vinegar." And she sat beside the reapers and he reached her parched corn and she did eat and was sufficed and left. It's a lovely thing to be satisfied, to be content. And of course, at Christmas time, there is a focus on eating. And the key, I suppose, to Christmas Day is not to overindulge so that you feel sort of ill after it all and you're looking for the rennies, but to be content, to be satisfied. It's a lovely thing to be satisfied. No, I couldn't take any more turkey. No, I couldn't take any more roast potato. I'm content. And here we find Ruth is content. We could think of her past, forgotten now. That stranger, that baggage that she carried about with her, the Moabitish girl, coming from a pagan, godless background. Oh, it's forgotten now. She's met Boaz. She's trusting in God, Jehovah. Her past is over. She's no longer treated like a stranger. She's been welcomed into the household of God. Her past is forgotten. We could think of her present. She is satisfied. She is sat at the meal and she has been given all that she needs and she is sufficed and she is all. Her stomach is full. She's contented. Her need is being met day by day. And we could think of her future that was all secure because of Boaz. I say, isn't it great to be spiritually satisfied? The past, gone. It's under the blood. Never to be held against us anymore. If we bring it to God, he'll say, "I don't know what you're talking about. It's all been dealt with. It will never be brought up against us." Our present, he has promised he will never leave us nor forsake us. He'll meet our need every single day. As we waken up, his blessings are new every morning. And what a future we have. We're surely satisfied, aren't we? The past is dealt with. The present is empowered. The future is secure. Can I ask you tonight in our meeting, are you satisfied? As we come to Christmas time again, where there's so much discontent. Everybody looking for the ultimate present and looking for the ultimate gift and wondering what they'll get or what they'll give and all the chaos. Isn't it great as the people of God, we can say before God, "I am content." You know, sometimes the children will say, "Dad, what would you like for Christmas? What would you like for your birthday?" And I honestly don't know what to say. And I say to him, "Look, I have everything I need. I really don't need anything." The past forgotten. A stranger accepted into the family. The present satisfied. He meets my need day by day. The future is glorious, full of hope because of our heavenly Boaz. You know, I don't believe that Ruth was ever satisfied back in Moab. It was where she brought up. She was familiar with it. Her family were there, her friends were there, her neighbors were there. She was used to it, but I don't think it ever satisfied her. Why? Because Moab speaks of the world. It's a picture of the world. And there's no lasting satisfaction in this old world. Remember when John 4, whenever the Lord is speaking to the woman at Sychar's well, and he said, if you drink of this water, you will thirst again. But if you drink of the water that I will give you, you will never thirst again. Satisfaction. He blesses. When we let him, sometimes we put up barriers. And we don't receive all the blessings that maybe we could have, but his blessings are there for us. Ruth went out one day hungry, working to starve off salvation, to get a little provision for her and her mother-in-law. And all of a sudden, when she's coming back, what a difference a day makes. Huh? One day can change your whole life. And we could spend time thinking about that, you know. Moses started one day as a baby fugitive, lying in a little basket among the bulrushes. And the parents had left him there to save his life. And by the time nighttime came, he was a prince in Egypt. Amazing day for baby Moses. Moses had a day whenever he was a shepherd in Midian. 40 years he had done the job. He had looked after his father-in-law, sheep, and Jethro seemed happy with his work, and he thought that he'd just do it the rest of his day. But he saw the bush that was not consumed, and before the day was out, he was transferred from being a shepherd in Midian to being a prophet of God, going down to Egypt to set his people free. What a difference a day makes. What about David? David started one day as a shepherd boy outside of Bethlehem. And before the day was over, he had been called in from the field. And the prophet Samuel was there. And he had been anointed the future king of Israel. What a day for David. One day David was sent as a messenger boy out to the battle to bring provisions to his brothers. And before the day was out, they were singing his praises. They were writing songs about him. Oh, Saul has killed his thousands, but David has tens of thousands. He was the hero of the hour. One day I started as a sinner. And before the day was out, I was a child of God. One day can make a big difference in your life. Maybe you started the day depressed. You can finish it rejoicing. Maybe you started the day uninvolved. You could finish it involved. Maybe you started the day doubting. You can end it victoriously. The difference a day makes. Ruth discovered that. What a difference that day gleaning in the field. Notice a few things about Ruth as we continue in chapter 2. Notice, please, her humility. I was thinking about this. For Ruth to glean, she had to bend low. For Ruth to benefit from the handfuls and purpose, she had to lower herself. And I thought, you know, there's a lesson in that for me. So often we miss out on the blessings of God because we won't get down. Pride robs us of God's handfuls. We don't have of him because we'll not stoop and take that low position. But Ruth knew humility, and she gets down to glean and pick up. And even though those handfuls dropped on purpose, she had to get down low to pick them up. Maybe some of us are too proud to get low. Think it's not what we should be doing. And we miss out thinking of ourselves greater than really what we are, instead of esteeming others better than ourselves. Humility. Secondly, notice productivity. Look at verse 7 of chapter 2. She said, I pray you, let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves. So she came and she continued even from morning until now, apart from a little time when she tarried in the house. Look at verse 17. So she gleaned in the field until even and beat out that she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. When Ruth ate and was satisfied, she did not go home. I think I'd have gone home. I've enough food gathered. I've now had my meal. I'm satisfied. I don't think I fancy going out and gleaning in the field again. That would be me. But not Ruth. Ruth went back to work until the even. And it just reminded me that there is always a work to be done. Even after we're content, even after we're satisfied, even after we feel that we've done all that we need to do, there's always a work. It's one of the problems of being a pastor. You see, some of you sign in to work maybe at 9 o'clock in the morning, and then you clock out again at 5:30 in the evening. A pastor doesn't do that. Pastor goes into a study maybe early in the morning, gets called out, visits to do, back into the study. And the problem is, you see, that there's never a moment in my life when I've nothing to do. Never. There's always people I could visit. Always. There is always things I need to study. There is never an end to it. There needs to be a productivity. And one of the dangers of my kind of work is making sure that somewhere along a week, somewhere along a time, that you take time out to recharge the batteries. It's very hard to do. David Cameron's learning that. Assignments, preparation, visitation, and it's just part of it. And here we find Ruth. She had productivity, and whenever she came in the morning and she gleaned, and then she went for a little while in the house, and then she's back out again, gleaning again, and we're told in verse 17 that she kept on gleaning until even, whenever you couldn't glean anymore because it was dark. What productivity by Ruth. Notice something else. Not only humility and productivity, but efficiency. You see, after she gleaned, we heard in verse 17, she gleaned in the field until even and beat out that she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. After she gleaned, she could have carried it all home. It was hers. But she didn't do that. No, she took it and she beat it out. It made it easier to carry. It also meant that whenever she got it home, it was ready for use. You see, she didn't want to carry the stems. They were of no use to Naomi. She didn't want to carry the husks. There was no nutritional value in the husks. And so she took it down to the threshing floor and she beat it and beat it to get the kernel of the barley out, and she brushed up and gathered all the barley and she left the stems and the husks behind. She only took with her that which was valuable and nutritious. I carry hurts. I carry scars. I carry criticism and painful memories. I carry rejection. The husks, no valuable to me, of no benefit to me. And Ruth is teaching me not to carry the things of no value. Not to carry the things that have no benefit. It's like carrying a rock. It's like the weight of life upon our shoulders. And it's painful. Ruth is teaching me to beat up what I glean and just get rid of all the stuff that is of no value and of no importance, that is not feeding me, not benefiting me, and only carry through, only carry with me that which is profitable and useful. Efficiency. Not only humility and productivity and efficiency, but also plenty. See, he gleans about an ephah of barley. Now, I don't know what that is, an ephah of barley. So I went to the theologians, and they told me that it's 4 pecks or 10 homers, and I was none the wiser. Huh? Didn't help me at all. And then I did a wee bit more research, and they told me that it was about 62 pints or 7¾ gallons. It's a lot after the husks and the stems are taken to have 7¾ gallons of barley. They say it was about 5 days' supply. Ruth had worked hard, and she did not take the advantage of, or take advantage of Boaz's interest to slack off, knowing that he would provide for. No, she put in a hard day's work. Of course, in any fellowship, you will get those who want to work and those who don't want to work. It's the same in every fellowship. Sometimes the work that needs done is obvious to all. Sometimes it is private and hidden, but just as vital. Sometimes it's in your home. Sometimes it's in the church. Sometimes it's in the community. Sometimes it's on your knees. But you will also get people who are happy to take and don't want to get involved in the work. Ruth worked hard and gathered plenty. Humility, productivity, efficiency, plenty. Let's slip another one in. Quality. Notice verse 18. And she took it up and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned, and she brought forth and gave her that she had reserved after she was sufficed. Look at verse don't worry, I'll get in a wee second. The point is this. There was some of what she gleaned herself. But there was other things that she gleaned or she benefited from that were given to her from Boaz. What she had left over from the meal with Boaz was gathered up and given to her. She didn't glean for it, but it was given to her. And I find that significant as a speaker. You see, sometimes there's food that I dig for. There's material that I study over and ponder over and think through, but there's other times whenever I give food that just seems to pop into my head. Now, it's a dangerous thing sometimes. Sometimes you just feel the Lord leading, and you didn't dig for it, you didn't research it, you didn't study it, but it just comes into your mind, and the thoughts just come. And here, Ruth had what she gleaned, but she also had what she was given that she didn't even glean for. Boaz gave liberty to glean, gave her what she had not gleaned, and there was a promise of more to come. Look at verse 21. Ruth the Moabite said, "He said unto me also that thou shalt keep fast by my young men until they have ended all my harvest." And we find in verse 23, she kept fast by the maidens of Boaz to glean unto the end of the barley harvest and of wheat harvest, and dwelt with her mother-in-law. So there was liberty to glean, there was handfuls of that which she hadn't gleaned, and there was the promise of more to come. And you will notice that Naomi is inquisitive. In verse 19, her mother-in-law said to her, "Where hast thou gleaned a day? Where wroughtest thou? Blessed be he that did take knowledge of thee." And she is curious as to what happened. I think that's common to all mothers-in-law. I'm not sure. I haven't done a survey on that. But they start to ask 20 questions. Back one. There she is. Start to searching, wanting to know all the details, trying to find out all the 20 questions. Where did you glean? Whose field did you go to? Ruth did her best to give Naomi an account of the kindness that she had received and added the vital clue to the whole story. She said, "The man's name with whom I wrought today is Boaz." And I think Naomi's heart missed a beat. Boaz. I know that name. I'm sure I know that name. Boaz. Let me think a wee minute. He's one of our near kinsmen. Oh, the Lord has guided today. The Lord has prepared the way. I'm related to this man that you've been gleaning in his field. He's a near kin unto us. Verse 20. Notice at the end of this chapter that Naomi is starting to change. In chapter 1, her life had fallen apart, but now God is starting to put things back together again. Isn't it wonderful when God takes our lives that we mess up and feel, and he has a way of putting them back together again? And that's what he's doing. And we notice here that Naomi has a whole new demeanor. She's mellowing, she's softening, because Boaz has arrived on the scene. Notice three things at the end of this chapter. Notice, first of all, there is a new word on Naomi's lips. She says in verse 19 and 20, she showed her mother-in-law with whom she had wrought, and said, "The man's name with whom I wrought today is Boaz." And Naomi said unto her daughter-in-law, "Blessed be he of the Lord, who hath not left off his kindness to the living and to the dead." And Naomi said unto her, "The man is near kin unto us, one of our next kinsmen. Blessed be he of the Lord." I don't think she had used that word for a long time. She certainly didn't feel blessed. In fact, instead of being blessed, she was bitter. She was bitter because of her empty home and the bereavement. She was bitter because of her empty hands. She had lost everything. She was bitter because of her empty heart. She was Mara, bitter. She had found very little to rejoice about. Everything for Naomi was negative. But when she saw the 5-day supply of barley and finds out who it was that helped Ruth, she said, "Blessed be he of the Lord." She admitted that Boaz was kind, admitted the Lord had been at work, and now the name of the Lord is once again on Naomi's lips, not this time with blame or bitterness, but with praise and thanksgiving. And it just could be I'm speaking to a Naomi, a chapter 1 Naomi. And all seems hopeless. And you're in despair and the future looks bleak. And maybe like Naomi, you blame God and say, "Where is God in this situation?" I want to tell you, on the authority of God's word, I want you to know that whenever you let Jesus Christ step into the situation, everything changes. Jesus, our heavenly Boaz, is here to help us, just as he helped Ruth and helped Naomi. And he's a way of putting our broken lives back together again. He can bring order out of chaos. He can bring wisdom to the confused. He can bring strength to the weak. He can bring direction to the lost. He can bring healing to the sick. He can bring ease to the hurting. He can bring comfort to the bereaved. And he can start to put our lives back together again. Naomi says, blessed. I think we don't use that word enough. I'm blessed. I was under pressure last week because of the PowerPoint not working. Some noticed that. And one day a brother said to me on Sunday, Pastor, you have a wee sign in your study. I said, yes. He says, it says, I'm too blessed to be stressed. Yeah. I needed to be reminded. Too blessed to be stressed. Like the psalmist in Psalm 103, bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me, bless his holy name. Our lives must not just contain acts of worship, but rather our lives should be an act of worship. The very way that we live should be an act of worship to the Lord. Worship must come before service. The king must come before the king's business. A.W. Tozer said, if you will not worship God 7 days a week, you will never worship him truly one day a week. I think that's very clever, very wise. If you will not worship God 7 days a week, you will never worship him truly or fully on one day a week. I agree with that. If I don't think about God from Monday morning through to Saturday night, I can't just switch it on automatically on a Sunday morning. I would go further. If I don't think of him Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, I can't switch it on a Saturday. And so, every day should be as an act of worship. And so there's a new word on Naomi's lips. Bless it. Secondly, there's a new hope in Naomi's heart. There we are. A new hope in Naomi's heart. Because of who Boaz was, their kinsman, one who was in a position, if willing, to marry the widow of a near relative who died, to marry and maintain his memory, his legacy, his inheritance. And so because of who Boaz was, he was a near kinsman. Because of what Boaz did, he took a personal interest in Ruth. And of all the people working in that field, all those handmaidens that he had employed to come and glean, and all those who had come to glean around the sides that they were by law allowed to do, he took an interest in Ruth. He protected her. He graciously provided for her. And thirdly, because of what Boaz said, stay in the field. My men will protect you. Wait until the end of all my harvest. Dear saint of God, we have hope in our hearts, don't we? Because of who Jesus Christ is, our kinsman redeemer, our savior, the one who can change everything. Not only because of who Jesus is, but because of what Jesus did. We could think of the incarnation, the crucifixion, the resurrection, the ascension, his intercession for us at the right hand of God. Because of what he did. And because of what Jesus said, let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. If I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where you, I am, there you may be also. Because of who he is, because of what he did, because of what he said. Let me finish. Not only a new word in Naomi's lips, not only a new hope in Naomi's heart, but a new motive in Naomi's advice. You see, Ruth coming home with the news that she had gleaned in the field of Boaz, and Boaz had told the reapers to throw handfuls on purpose, that she was to sit at his table, that she was to dip her morsel into the vinegar, and that anything she didn't eat was parceled up like a wee doggy bag and sent home with her, and all the care, and you come and my men will look after you, and you stick by my maidens, and not just for the barley harvest, but right through to the wheat harvest. Ruth could have stayed at home the next day. Couldn't she? Why? Because she had the heart of Boaz. She could have sat at home and waited for Boaz to perform his duties as the kinsman redeemer. In verse 2, way back at the start of the chapter, it was Ruth who sought permission to glean. But now in verse 22, it is Naomi who has a new motive. And it's Naomi who says, "It is good, my daughter, that thou go out with his maidens, that they meet thee not in any other field." And now it's not Ruth is the initiator, but Naomi is the initiator. And she says there is a benefit in gleaning. There's the produce, but there is a potential because you will meet Boaz. Stay near to him. Stay close to him. And so even though Ruth could have stayed at home at this point because she had the eye and the heart of Boaz, there was a benefit in reaping in the harvest field. One of the saddest things in today's church is that the church has lost its motive in gleaning in the harvest field. That passion for mission seems to have been lost. Verse 2, she volunteered, of course, to serve in the harvest field. Verse 2, she obtained permission from those in authority. Verse 9, she refused to get distracted. Boaz said, "Let your eyes be in the field." Verse 14, she was satisfied by the Lord of the harvest. Verse 17, she worked until it was impossible to work anymore. It was evening time. And in the church today, there is a lack of interest. I know of a Baptist church that arranged a mission and the elders wouldn't even go to it because they saw no need. No need. Missionary societies tell me that when they ring round looking for deputation meetings, many churches say, "No, we don't want any missionary representatives." Because they have a logic that says God will build his church, it's his business, the church will be perfect in heaven, therefore it doesn't matter whether we evangelize or send missionaries out at all, it's a fait accompli, it's already done and dusted. And yet the sovereign purposes of God says go. God's sovereign plan is that we will go to reap the harvest. God's sovereign purposes are tied up to us being evangelists for him. And so I say in Galatians 6 and 9, let us not be weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap if we faint not. Chapter 1. We saw Ruth weeping. Chapter 2, we see Ruth working. Next time, God willing, next Tuesday night, we'll get into chapter 3 and we'll see Ruth waiting. May God bless his word to our hearts.